Hello and welcome to a special crossover episode, Radio Warnerd and American Prestige. Before we get to it, just make sure to subscribe to these shows. For Radio Warnerd, go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And for our friends at American Prestige, go to AmericanPrestigePod.com. I am Mark Ames, the co-host of Radio Warnerd, and I'm with, of course, the co-host John Dolan, a.k.a. The Warnerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Southern Italy. And we are, of course, talking with Danny and Derek from American Prestige. So let's get right to our episode. Okay, so Danny and Derek, where do we even begin? I don't know if you guys are right with it. I would like to begin with Trump's latest mood swing as expressed on Truth Social, which came out yesterday. And it's interesting only because of the reaction to this, I think. It doesn't need to be read. I'm so tired of this guy. But basically, he's put off supposedly destroying Iran and their energy infrastructure for 10 days. And that was supposed to be a big deal because today, as we're recording this, he was supposed to have already obliterated all of Iran's energy infrastructure. So he announces
the planes that he would no doubt call warbirds or something else was supposed to be flying.
Yeah, and it didn't. And instead, he did one of his announcements, and I'm sure there were people in his crew who, you know, traded on the announcement, traded oil and whatever other commodities on the announcement. But the thing that I found so interesting is that in all of his other announcements, either we're about to end this war, it's going to be a ceasefire, oil collapses by 10-15%. I'm going to obliterate him, oil rises another 10%. This time, it barely went down, and it's already, I believe it's already up to where it was before he made the post. So it didn't move markets. And so it seems to, what that says to me, I think, is that the financial markets, which have been oddly, like, kind of paralyzed and, I think, delusional in not really seeing how long and bad this war is and can be and will be, most likely. But now it seems like they're starting to think everything this guy says is bullshit and he's not in control of the situation. What do you guys think?
Yeah, do you guys believe that he's actually going to wait 10 more days to do something? Like, I'm not even sure I believe that.
No.
Yeah, like it feels like a dumb guy who thinks he's a genius trying to sucker the Iranians into believing something.
Right, and he will think that it worked the first time.
Yeah,
right.
When he bombed that elite meeting.
Yeah.
And then he sort of boasted in a strange way, I don't have anybody left to talk to. I was going to negotiate, but I killed them all. Whoops.
Yeah.
Oopsie.
Yeah, that was a boast.
He'll think it worked last year when the Israelis like interrupted the negotiations, or presumably with U.S. permission to do the 12-day war. He'll think it worked this last time when he was negotiating with the Iranians right up to the point of war, without kind of comprehending that, like, every time you do that, you lose credibility. Like, you don't have much credibility to begin with.
Well,
every time you pull that move.
Yeah, and it's also, like, I mean, I am firmly convinced that the economy in this country is mostly not real, in the sense that it's based on asset price inflation and financialization and really organized around monopoly. And so in the entire economic environment that Trump has spent his life, smoke and mirrors really functioned because there was no base to it. But when you're actually talking about something here, there's an actual raw material commodity here. And the United States is not used to dealing with that. And it hasn't really been used to dealing with that as a center of its political economy for a long time, despite the fact that the United States produces so much energy. So I think we're also seeing something that people who have led this country now for a decade plus haven't really seen in their political lifetimes, because it really hasn't occurred since the 1970s, which is that this rubber of fake American financialization is hitting the road of raw material exports. And so we're entering kind of a new era that they're not used to. And I think this is ultimately reflective of that you could only bullshit so much when there's an actual commodity at the center. When you're talking about like fake financial transactions, like, you know, Skydance purchasing Paramount or whatever it may be, you could kind of just bullshit around. But this is almost a different quality of economic transaction that Trump, who, you know, is a debt finance, constantly bankrupt guy, is really not used to. There's something real here in a philosophical sense that the markets, I guess, are finally going to ultimately respond, or in this case, not respond to.
Well, yeah, and to your point, Danny, there has been a lot of talk about this, this massive spread between the paper oil, which is what, you know, traders, what financial speculators trade, and the actual physical barrels of oil, which is far more expensive. That's starting to close some, but, you know, a paper contract that you trade around for a barrel of oil was like $100 a barrel, but to buy the actual Omani or UAE crude in Asia costs like $170, $180 a barrel because you actually need the physical product. So I think that we have no idea where this is going. And as we get into this sort of darkness, Trump is going to keep sort of lashing out, trying to, I mean, I see a lot of what his strategy is just trying to show that he is in control and that he can dominate. And I think that's why he is probably going to do a land invasion, which is going to be very not fake, you know. When I say a land invasion, I mean trying to take a strip of coast or take an island and, you know, probably pretty soon. What do you guys think about that?
I think it's inevitable. Like, what else is left to do at this point? And to your point about the divergence between real things and fake things, there's a sense in which, like, the way that the U.S. fights war is fake. We fight air wars, you know, that produce missile strikes and air strikes, and it's very real for the people who suffer them. But for us, and especially for this president, it's just an explosion on a TV screen or, you know, something that somebody shows you and puts together in a social media reel. I don't know if you guys saw the story about his briefings. He's getting a 2-minute video of just compilations of airstrikes landing in Iran, and that's his daily briefing. No wonder he's out to lunch. But, like, once you put soldiers on an island or a strip of coast that they then can't move off of, that they're sitting ducks for whatever the Iranians have to throw at them, that becomes very real for the U.S., not just for the Iranians. And, you know, I don't know, like, that's something that the U.S. hasn't done since Iraq, really. I mean, we've had troops in other places, but not in the sense of you could lose hundreds or thousands of people.
Right, right. And KIA are kind of hard to hide. Not impossible, though. They can be hidden or described as among the wounded until they quietly die, and then you confess it when it's not going to hurt you anymore. I mean, there's a lot of that going around. In fact, the big Iranian Sejil missile that hit an Orthodox town in Israel was reported in a classic sort of terrorist bombing way, like
180 injured.
And nobody died? That's weird. So casualties are already in play to be fudged.
Do you guys have the sense, and like I'd be curious, John, especially for your take on this. It struck me the other day, like, to the extent that anybody in the Trump administration talks about what the Iranians have done to retaliate for being attacked, there's this like almost at the surface level of like, this isn't fair. They're not supposed to fight back against us. Like, how dare they? And I mean, that's a thing that runs through a lot of, you know, U.S. wars and the, you know, especially as you get into the like post-Cold War in the 21st century. But I'm sure it was true in Vietnam, and like, there's this sense that, like, who are these people? Who do they think they are? But it's so overt with these guys that it really hit me. And I wonder if, like, this is true of empires at other times in history, like, that they just sort of have this level of disbelief that the natives would lash out like this. Why don't they just let us do what we want?
Mark and I were talking about this, and I think it's useful to remember how badly Britain, maybe the most successful, using it, you know, not in the non-normative sense, as Nietzsche would say, successful empire of the last millennium, did in the 19th century. If you look at Britain in the late 18th century, it's not doing that well in most ways. I mean, there's the loss of the USA, which gave, who was that actor who I think played in The Madness of King George?
Oh, yeah.
Who gave him a chance to emote acting for whole scenes. But then there was the development of a revolutionary ideology in France that turned out to be militarily very formidable. And not only that, but something most people have forgotten, the mutiny of the British fleet at Spithead and the Nore, which came that close in the 1790s to turning the fleet, the last line of defense for the UK, into a revolutionary organization that would have been against the state. You fast forward 50 years later, they own everything. I mean, empires can just turn on a dime, not as quickly, but it's hard to predict anything about what they'll end up.
And to your other point about the unfairness, I mean, I've seen this all along. I remember, well, first of all, John and I have brought this up a lot in shows, but there's this one of the many great Far Side cartoons that you can reference. It's the one where the sort of the pioneers are with their guns and their wagons behind them, and they're all in stances shooting. And then they look and see that the Indians have fired arrows that have fire on them and are starting to say, and they say, and
are they
look,
allowed to do that?
Yeah, can they do that? Yeah. And that is like, I can't tell you, that was the Iraq War for sure. Like, they can't do this. We won the conventional war. I can't tell you how many articles. I mean, it was a source of kind of fun for the exile in the Warner days, like all of these articles coming out that the dead enders are cheating. You're supposed to stand out in columns and in lines and fight against, you know, and get strafed by our A-10s or something. Like, this is not fair, blowing up, you know, the odd, you know, APC or whatever every now and then. Like, it's not fair. And I'm sure, I mean, I was too young for Vietnam, but I'm sure, John, I seem to remember. No, I mean, I remember it even right after Vietnam as I was becoming conscious. The whole idea was they didn't fight fair. And our hands were tied behind our backs and everything was,
I mean,
not fair.
I think most people have seen what was the Stallone movie?
Rambo First Blood.
Rambo First Blood or something like. I think in the second one where he defeats the triumphant Viet Cong with arrows that have cute little gadgety warheads on them. But he says to his liaison officer, "Are we allowed to win this time?" And that was a popular myth that we could have won if we just, you know, taken the gloves off or whatever. And it went way, way up the chain of command like that. That dummy, Westmoreland, who was, far as I know, the dumbest, just plain dumbest commander of any major American war, said long after the war ended, "I consider that we won because, you know, we killed 10 times as many of them as they did of us." It's like, where'd you learn those rules?
I mean, that reminds me of Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said, or at least I saw him quoted this morning, saying that the Strait of Hormuz is not a choke point of the global economy. And we won Vietnam because Westmoreland thinks like you could just say things that have absolutely no basis in reality whatsoever. But it is kind of weird coming from the people who actually run things to be
this. I mean, a couple of times, like Rubio said this the other day, I think Hank said something similar like a week or two ago. They're like, you know, the Strait of Hormuz would be open today if the Iranians just opened it and stopped shooting at people. Like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I would be, as somebody said, I would be a billionaire if I just had $1 billion. Like, okay, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like.
So, I don't know, go back real quickly, though, to the idea of this land invasion, and which I guess really comes down to what you guys think. I'd like to hear what you think, what the war strategy is. Now, like, and maybe then where it looks like the war is going. I mean, of course, the first question is there a strategy? But there's always some consideration for whatever you're doing, even if it's just to make a good 2-minute video for Donald Trump. But what do you think, Derek and Danny?
Well, it's funny, guys. Sorry, I was muted. My bad. But
you probably said the most brilliant things. And it was lost like tears and rain.
Yeah, like dust in the fucking wind. Just a couple things. Well, I think just very quickly, a point that was just recently made. This does remind me a lot of Vietnam, especially because I think there was a misconception that you would be able to communicate through violence. I think that was how this war began. I think Trump literally thought, remember, Derek, we were talking about, he thought they were going to do these 2-day aerial strikes, and then you're going to go back to the talks, and you're going to do this. So this is, I think, a misconception that has been held in American grand strategy for a very, very long time, that you could have a logical escalation ladder through which violence is a form of communication. And so I think that was the strategy. Just to get back to the point, that I think initially they went into this war that they are going to be able to do these bombings, make some sort of concession, you know, literally kill the Ayatollah. Iran would come back hat in hand. And I think they really, which is incredible to consider because it is so obvious both beforehand, while it is happening, and in retrospect, that they could just attack the Gulf. For some reason, that seems to have not been a general strategic consideration. So I think that the United States is essentially now searching around for a strategy, and there just isn't one. Because the strategies, I think you guys are right. I think there's going to have to be an escalation to some form of land invasion, some form of setting up a beachhead like the Dane Law in 9th century or 10th century England, because there's nowhere to go because they didn't actually think it through. So I think this is very much an improvised strategy, whatever is happening. I think Israel is happy because I think that it is going to achieve its regional strategy, which is destabilize Iran. Iran is certainly going to be destabilized regardless of what happens here. And the United States is really stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I think you're going to see, again, I think this is Trump's idea, is that he's going to be able to communicate by putting troops on the ground. And I think that's going to prove incorrect. Now, I don't think there's the political will like there was during, for, you know, the first half of Vietnam or during Iraq to maintain this. So there's going to be, I think, a domestic political wall that Trump and the GOP in general are going to confront relatively soon. And then you have questions. I don't think that he's going to try to stop the election or anything like that. You never really know. But I mean, it's not so absurd to think that the deployment of these 19-year-old ICE agents to airports is, you know, trying to figure out what he's going to be able to do with state security forces. But I mean, I think you could get into some really dark places pretty quickly with the connection here between international and domestic politics.
Absolutely. Which I think, I think another consideration about what the strategy is, I mean, there's sort of a military strategy to, I don't know, try to win or try to dominate. But there's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think strategy mostly revolves right now around how to make Donald Trump look good in this. And it's not a small thing. I mean, it's happened before, not even just Trump. With Trump, it's worse, but what do you think?
It feels like the story about the Daily Brief, like, really, really hit me. Like, I don't even know if it's making Trump look good publicly. Like, I think the strategy for anybody in the administration right now is to, let's make the war look good so that I don't get fired. Like, so he doesn't get mad at me because he's, you know, he can't hear bad news and he doesn't have any attention span to listen to anything complicated. So let me just distill this down to some explosions like the you know, that Simpsons gag when buildings collapse. Like, you know, just let me distill it down to that and get out of there. But yeah, I mean, to your point, Mark, about what is the strategy? I don't think they've budged on it. I think they're still on the Delcy Rodriguez plan. Mm. Like, you know, the idea was we go in, we take out Khamenei, somebody else steps in who says uncle, and we'll do whatever we want in Tehran. And amazingly, at the end of week four of this, having not found that person, or the Israelis killing everybody who might have, you know, filled that role. I don't think there was anybody who would have, but just on the off chance, we're still there. Like, that's what this whole thing with Ghalibaf has been. Like, yeah.
Yeah. 10 minutes research into recent Iranian history would have changed their views. Like,
it's wild.
What was Iran doing during the 1980s? Well, they were losing 400,000 people in a long, horrible, bloody war featuring a lot of suicide charges by 15-year-olds across marshes full of mines, so that the more elite troops could follow and wipe out the Iraqi people who were sheltering behind those mines. I mean, there was a lot of grisly heroism and different phases of the Iranians attacking Iraqi cities and Iraqis attacking Iranian cities. And generally, although the Iranians decided they would eventually stop because they'd proved their point and it was pointless. It was like, as that barfly guy would say, "Your fucking cuts are opening up and everything." Oh no, that's LaMotta. But anyway, they just had terrified, frankly, the Iraqis, who were a very mercenary force. I mean, cruel, but mercenary, and they couldn't handle it.
And I would add to that, you know, I don't know if people remember, but the Iraqis were backed by all the wealthy Gulf states. Mm. And you know, I've seen some people in the Gulf kind of having flame wars with some pro-Iranian people, and they all start digging up history fast, and the Iranians immediately go to, "You supported Saddam Hussein and killed hundreds of thousands, including poison gassing our people." They remember it like it was yesterday. But so they were supported by the Gulfs, supported by all the Western countries, including the United States, of course, and supported by the Soviet Union. And all of that power was on one side with Iraq, and on the other side was this isolated Iranian state.
Well, Israel sold them weapons, right?
Yeah,
I'm remembering.
Yeah. They did, in order, because the Israelis wanted them to kill each other. And yeah, and even Reagan sold them some weapons too. But it was the Israelis did, I think. The Israelis, it took them a while to really get it through their heads that the Iranians truly didn't like them, because they had such a good, long relationship, I think, with the Shah's regime. But and that war, you know, this is the thing about like the Ukraine war and so many wars we cover in our show. These wars so often start off, nobody expects it to be a long war. I mean, maybe you could say that with World War II, people thought it might be. It's like one of the rare ones. But like the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein didn't go into that thinking it was going to be a long war. And once that war clearly hit a stalemate, which was pretty early on, you know, it took years before it finally came to some kind of really ugly and unsatisfying resolution. And so this could go on a long time.
Well, Mark, I have a question for you guys, you as well, John. One of the things that I'm really focusing on here is China's response to this war, because I'm trying to think through what does this post-American century moment look like in terms of U.S. geostrategy. And my take now, it's early on, is that China is essentially ceding this region to the United States, broadly speaking, that it's going to be considered to be within the United States' quote-unquote sphere of influence as we enter this new multipolar world, that despite the brokering of the 2023 Saudi-Iran treaty and despite various inroads that China has made, it does seem like they're kind of taking a hands-off approach and allowing the United States to get mired down here. which does indicate to me that, like, quote unquote, going forward, and particularly as fossil fuels become less important to the global economy, and this might be a real hinge point in that development, which is kind of a separate story. But what do you think about how the other major powers are responding to this? Because to me, we don't hear much about it, but that is a really important element.
Well, but me personally, I don't know about you, Gemma, I'm not really surprised by that. I think the Chinese look at all this kind of empire management that the U.S. does and think, I don't want to do that. Now, they may get forced to at some point because the U.S. is such a force for destabilization constantly and may weaken itself to a certain point. But I don't think they want to. They want things to be stable, and then the U.S. goes in and fucks it up, and then they try and stabilize it again. So, what else? I've seen people say, for example, there was a whole contingent of these kind of think tankers and media people who in DC who always, they have this real thing about Russia that is, it's an old brain worm, ha ha, look at Iran, Russia doesn't come and support Iran, ha ha ha, Russia's so weak. But like, Russia's not going to go to war for Iran, China's not going to go to war for Iran, China won't go to war for the Saudis, I don't think. I'd be hugely surprised, why would they? But they are, I think I'm a little bit more surprised that the Russians and Chinese are actually helping them more in this war than they've kind of helped any American adversary, at least since the post-Cold War era. We don't know a lot still about what help they're giving. And, you know, there's a lot of propaganda kind of mixed up. There seems to be a big effort to overstate Russian help, although I do believe it's definitely there, with drone technology and intelligence and so on, and an effort to kind of understate what China's help. And from what I'm hearing from various sources, China is giving a lot of intelligence, satellite help, and probably their GPS system, the BDS system, help them sort of move over to that system.
Well, which means that, in a sense, for China, the U.S. is like one of the two parties in the Iran-Iraq war of the 1980s. Mm. And in that they're supplying intelligence to one of the two sides in order to further weaken the other side, which seems really possible to me. I mean, I've lived through an incredible decline in American power, most of which was willed with a lot of help from Israel. There's a lot of Israeli, why don't you do this? And it's always disastrous. But there's a lot of American cliff jumping. I mean, there was cliff jumping without, you know, parachutes or anything, because we thought we could. And I doubt it. For China, I mean, like, I don't know, what was a mid-range or up-and-coming power, maybe even the U.S., doing in the Franco-Prussian War? They were looking at it and saying, ain't that a corker?
Yeah.
Let's use that to jump off to another question that I kind of posed earlier, which is, and I think it is important, is there's a general sense you see a lot of that the U.S. empire is in decline because things that we are used to have gone by the wayside, such as, you know, all this kind of lip service and maybe some, in fact, international law, humanitarian law, norms, and so on. They've kind of gone by the wayside. So it certainly does feel like a lot of decadence. But on the other hand, you know, American power, and I was reading your essay, I completely agree with it. American power is still vast compared to any other country. I mean, no one even comes close. No, American financial power, just for starters, and American dominance over the kind of global financial system, which is power, is absolutely unrivaled. Obviously, the economy, maybe the underlying economy is a different story, where China is actually a real powerhouse. The American military is, I think, still unmatched by anybody. Of course, you cliff dive several times and that changes. But do you think that that this is an empire in decline, or is, like, as John was kind of suggesting with the late 18th century British example, it's just another sort of dip in, and this can just drag on for a long imperial time?
So I've thought about this a lot. I mean, I guess this is kind of my central subject. So, I mean, it is, I think it's, it has to start from the point that the United States was just absurdly powerful in 1945, controlling half of world's production, and really the only developed nation that had an air force so much more powerful than the Soviet Union. The more we learn about what the Soviet Union was actually like, it was really a hyperpower for a very long time. And then, of course, after 1989, China is still very much in development mode. The Soviet Union has collapsed, and it was crazy powerful. So I think that that is the starting point, because that sort of historical situation, to my mind as a historian, is genuinely unprecedented. The sheer power of the United States, particularly in the immediate post-World War II period, where it had an atomic monopoly, had the world's own real air force, it really controlled exports and imports, manufacturing, the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it would be impossible not to decline from that position, whether you're looking at 45 or 89, in both absolute and relative terms. And when you look at the hard data, that's just a fact. If you look at the United States' share of global GDP, even if you expand that to the G7, which are essentially at this point, for all intents and purposes, vassals of the United States, the share of global GDP has just been in serious decline. China's has been on the rise to a significant degree. India's is also on the rise, not as much as China's. And then even if you look at military spending, I think between 1990 and the 2024, which is when I think the last data was available, China has spent like a 3,000% increase in military spending. So from any perspective, the United States is in both absolute decline and relative decline. However, it was so powerful. Way more powerful than the British ever were, way more powerful than the French ever were, way more powerful than the Romans or Ottomans or Austro-Hungarians or any sort of analogous imperial force you would be able to look at ever was. So then we're in a really historically unprecedented situation where a genuinely global hegemon who is leaps and bounds ahead of everyone else is in some form of decline. So I think what I'm trying to figure out is, what is this going to new geostrategic environment going to look like at the end of what I've been, you know, calling the American century, you know, the Henry Luce phrase from 1941, and I do think really became something real until around 2016. And that project was upheld by political power, military power, economic power, and cultural power. And I think one of the major things that we've seen in the last 10 years, and then I'll hopefully wind down this rant in a second, is that that cultural sort of leg in the stool of American power has genuinely gone away, that the United States is not viewed like it really was for much of the American century as a premier power that one wanted to emulate. And you even see it here at home, when one of the reasons that Trump, I think the fact that Trump didn't even try to manufacture consent for this war is just an artifact that we are moving away from a cultural imperialism to a more hard-nosed political, economic, and military imperialism. And I think probably the major feature that I'm seeing right now is the decline of ideology as a key structure and condition of international relations. So if you look at the Cold War, and then I'll just end on this point. If you look at the Cold War, it was to some real degree, and I agree with Odd Arna Westad here, an ideological struggle between two ways to basically to manage the fruits of industrial modernity. You have the communist one and you have the liberal capitalist one. But what happened after the Soviet Union fell is that everyone in the world essentially became capitalist except North Korea, which is so reliant on a capitalist power, China, that, you know, it is effectively part of the system. So as capitalism came to dominate all forms of political economy in the world. I think what we're seeing, the really unique thing that we're seeing in the last 10 or so years, 15 or so years, is the decline of ideology as an important causal force in international relations. And so, and to some degree, people have heard me say this 5 million times at this point, Fukuyama was right when he said that liberalism was going to be the final ideology. He thought that liberalism was going to spread over the world, but what we're actually seeing is the attenuation of ideology as a justifying feature of international politics itself. And so we're seeing a return, I think, to the model that FDR envisioned in 1943 at the Tehran Conference, which is this four policeman model of international relations, when you're going to see basically retreats to various spheres of influence. And what's interesting is that I think the Middle East is going to, as I said earlier, going to be part of the United States' sphere. So that's sort of my macro galaxy brain take. I'm writing a piece on this now, which is why I had the argument all set out on what we're seeing going forward.
And I think to sort of extend the point about us being in historically uncharted times, I mean, we've never been at a place where the global hegemon, with the entry of like a code into a computer, could destroy human civilization. And so, you know, is the U.S. empire going to burn out or fade away? It's not going to burn out. Like, this isn't going to end with the global alliance tanks rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue and the United States defeated in war, because that's not a possibility in the nuclear age. It's going to have to fade away. And I've seen people compare what's happening right now with Iran to the Suez Crisis, which was the point where the UK had to acknowledge that it was no longer a global power, and they were forced to by the US. And I think about that scenario, and is the US entering a point where it's going to have to just sort of face the facts that it's not that country anymore, that empire anymore? And I don't know, because who's going to come after? Like, in 1956, it was obviously the US was there to pick up the pieces and continue on. But like, who's there now? It's not China, and certainly the U.S. wouldn't be comfortable handing things over to China at any rate. So I don't know. I mean, I just feel like this could go for a long time, because we're not going to acknowledge losing power. And so we can, because of, you know, America's continued military might and economic might, we can continue to at least pretend to have it. And that's enough to seriously affect world affairs and cause a huge amount of mayhem in the process.
I would just counter that really briefly, and I'm going to preface it by saying I'm not a big fan of the U.S. empire. I wish there was a way politically to influence it. And I think there's also one thing you wrote about, Danny, in your piece, is that, you know, the snuffing out of mass politics. And I think this is something you see now, like John and I were talking before, and John is outside of the country, and he's just, and I think a lot of people are just baffled by the fact that although this war has so little support, that it's kind of unprecedented how poorly it polls. There's no protest movement at all to speak of. It's really weird.
Right. So I'm sorry. I just want to, yeah. I thought of an anecdote that in this regard that really brings it home, like when the U.S. just decided to start bombing Iraq. And I was taking my dog to the dog park in El Cerrito or Pinole or whatever it was in the North Bay. And a woman said, well, they did it. He decided to do it. And I thought, who did what? Is my dog doing something? And it was like, Bush, she had some name for him, decided to start bombing Iraq. And that was the first time people tried what became known later as shock and awe. And I think Trump, by the way, did one of the worst versions of shock and awe in the world. But that was something that stunned everybody. It was like an electric shock in a different way. And I don't know about you guys. You're in the U.S., but I mean, Mark and I were arguing about this. Like, I don't see much evidence of anything. Is that what No Kings is about? Because it seems like the dumbest
no.
motto for a movement I ever heard of.
I think No Kings, if you ask me, they came up with No Kings because they got scared when Bernie, and there's, they didn't have to be scared, but anything scares them. Bernie and AOC were touring around on a No Oligarchs campaign. And the problem is the Democrats are backed by oligarchs. So they yeah. oh, so they change it to fine. No Kings it's because kings. We don't have kings. Because yeah, we don't have a king, but you can pretend Trump is a king. And no, it's, they, the war is, I mean, I think they say you can make the war a part of your decentralized, you know, little protest in your little town, but we're not going to say that's what it's about. They're just, I mean, the Democrats are just, they're not an opposition party. But we could talk about that. But I just wanted to make a point about decline as somebody who is older and for better and for worse, or for worse and for worse, that growing up in the 1970s and kind of coming to consciousness, political consciousness, whatever, it just as the U.S. Was thoroughly defeated in Vietnam and you know, driven out, and the president was forced to resign in this incredible scandal a year after the vice president was forced to resign in an incredible scandal. And the, you know, the U.S. military was a basket case in the 70s. I don't think people can really grasp it unless you were there at the time. You can read statistics or whatever, but it was considered culturally, and I think in real terms, a complete joke, the U.S. military. It was even thought that those days were over, you know, in the Carter years, certainly the early Carter years, because it was such a failure and such a loser institution, and the ideas of militarism in popular culture were considered sort of retrograde, like segregationism or something. And there was so much, there are so many signs of decadence at the time. I mean, more and more countries, it seemed like more and more people or countries were in the developing world were turning towards Marxist-friendly, you know, leaders or forms of government. At home, at least growing up in the Bay Area, with bombings all the time. Patty Hearst was kidnapped. The mayor of San Francisco was assassinated. Then you had the People's Temple thing. Like, and inflation, and the U.S. could not control the economy anymore. It seemed to have no control over the direction of the economy. I mean, it seemed like it was over. And then you had this clown, this proto-Trump, Ronald Reagan, coming in. It didn't seem real when he was elected president. And it certainly didn't seem like things would turn for the better. And that's a whole different story. Better, I mean, in quotes, certainly for the empire and so on. But I guess my point is just that, kind of going back to what John said, like you don't know how empires go. You know?
So, Mark, yeah. I think the big difference there is that there was an escape valve, and that was essentially the neoliberal solution, which is that you could essentially deregulate everything and financialize everything. And it turns out that providing that liquid to the economy was actually able, I would argue, to artificially boost it for several decades. And I think that was the response to the real stagnation of mid-century Fordism. I don't think we have that escape valve any longer. And I think I would argue that is the difference. I look at this in terms of like the history of media. And it turns out like deregulation and financialization was actually really good for everyone in the 80s and the 90s, because it essentially just flooded the system with capital. And you were able to like develop in Hollywood hundreds of spec scripts, none of which would ever get made.
Debt.
But
flooded, right, with debt. Debt.
Flooded, yeah, with debt. Flooded, yeah, with debt. And then Obama did another artificial thing by essentially just lowering interest rates to zero, which allowed for, to take just one random example, Disney to purchase Pixar and Lucasfilm. Mm-hmm. Well, it was Lucasfilm and Marvel, et cetera, et cetera.
And quantitative easing.
Right, yeah, quantitative. Yeah. I think we're coming to the end of that runway is what I would argue. There's literally nothing more to deregulate or financialize, which is what AI is trying to do. The only thing to go for is labor. But right. I think there's not, labor is not that much a part of the economy any longer. Yeah. So you're basically going for the part of the economy that is ultimately weakest. You're not going to save that much like you did with deindustrialization when you essentially offshore manufacturing or automate manufacturing. They're essentially trying to offshore and automate white-collar work, but it's just not as important to the economy any longer. So I would say, like, you're right about the 70s, but there were various, like, escape hatches that they were able to take that to my read on the current situation, aren't really available. I mean, just look at we're worse than the Gilded Age in terms of inequality. Mm-hmm. And from what I remember, it's not even close. That could really only go on for so long. And I think China's already eating our lunch. I think that's pretty obvious, particularly in green technology. And we've had people on our pod that talk about how these empires literally are always organized around control of energy. So mm-hmm. I think, like, from my read, you guys are right. Like, there are moments where the empire seems down and out, but it comes back. I think I would guess we're at a different moment. I could, of course, be wrong, but that's where I'm coming from here.
I would just say two things. One is, in the late 70s, neoliberalism looked like an insane idea. It was retrograde and so on. It was pretty, like, nobody knew at that time. In retrospect, you know, I agree with you, because it just unlocked all kinds of capital and eviscerated one part of the country and, you know, enriched another part, but it made everything a lot more dynamic again. But nobody knew that, I don't think, or very few, very few people knew that or guessed that, I think, in the late 70s. But the other thing I would say, too, to your point, is that the Soviet Union was never the rival that the U.S. made it out to be, which, you know, something you said. And that played also, I think, a really big role in American re-ascendance in the 80s and you know, and then, of course, afterwards. Whereas China is the first real rival that the American empire, certainly since the Cold War, you know, since World War II, it's the first real rival we've had. So it's hard to say where that will go. If China is smart, they're not going to try and run the world for a long, long time, but sort of let the Americans, you know, do that cliff diving over and over and make the world maybe a little bit easier to run, because that seems to be at least the Trump faction's way of running. Well, actually, Biden's too, is to make the world such a messed up place. I don't know, that's how you kind of gain control and leverage and hopefully knock China off of its path towards success. And China, unless I guess we directly attack them or Taiwan, China is not going to take the bait.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that just to get a cultural element, I mean, I think the United States is unique. It's ultimately quite a Protestant country. It has a millenarian view on politics and geopolitics. It thought very in like a genuine way in the mid-1940s that it was pushing capital H history and capital P progress forward. And I think that was the cultural reason that it tried to achieve a genuine global hegemony, which I think as the 20th and 21st centuries have shown was an absurd proposition that caused a lot of death and destruction and deracination abroad. And oftentimes I think the United States, when we look at George Kennan, or when we look today, when people try to understand Chinese geostrategy, they read our own Protestant millenarianism onto other countries. I think Stalin pretty early didn't think that he was going to have global revolution. You have various feints toward it with Khrushchev and Brezhnev. I don't particularly think they were especially serious. And I think China wants to be regionally dominant. I think it is going to be regionally dominant, but nothing about the history of that country or its leadership suggests that it thinks it's bringing global communist revolution to the world. So I think that, again, this is why I do believe that we're going to return to the spheres of influence world, which is going to have problems and going to have opportunities as well.
I push back one more time on this, but I don't know how old you guys are, but you know, when W ran this country into the ground, I mean,
I'm 19.
Okay. All right. So you were aware of what was going on. when he ran the country into the ground, you know, I was thinking this when you were describing your kind of thesis earlier, that what you have a lot is America, the kind of governing classes of America were like these people who came into the largest fortune of anybody in history. And then the kids become more and more degenerate over time and waste and blow it, but they still have so much that they're all still filthy rich. But anyway, but when Bush came to power, like, there were a lot of similarities with Trump. Now, some of the language was different. He tapped into that national religion of, you know, spreading democracy and human rights and this kind of bullshit. But in general, they were mostly talking about how, you know, the Europeans can basically go screw themselves if they're not on board. You're either with us or against us. And by the end of Bush's reign, people hated America. They thought this country was a freaking joke, that it was incompetent, violent, crazy, that Americans had voted for this dumb shit a second time after it was clear he had destroyed everything. I remember I was outside of the country at the time. I could still hear ringing in my ears this British banker in Moscow when the results were coming in. And he drunk himself silly as the results were coming in. He just said, "I can't fucking believe it. I can't fucking believe it. They voted him. I can't." It's just, you know, this was the sense of people outside of America. And then what did we do? We voted in, it was like a flea flicker. We voted in an African-American, very well-spoken, said all the things that the world wanted to hear. And everybody came running back, loving us, giving him a Nobel Prize just for being black and elected, like before he went and screwed up the world again. Like, I guess my point is that I feel like I've just seen this before, and that whoever follows Trump, assuming he doesn't cancel elections and completely destroy what, you know, this kind of electoral oligarchy that we have, could very well bring back, as the title of your podcast is, American prestige. How's that?
I mean, if it brings us as American prestige some extra fame and fortune, I'd be fine with that.
So I would only just say very, very quickly that we're all good Marxists here. So I think we would look at like the G7 share of global GDP. So I think it was something, just doing quick Google here, but it seems to be a roughly correct thing. It was at its lowest estimate, 40% in 2000. But now it's like in its low 20%. So that's a halving of power. So I think, like, even if you look at, you know, I agree about the whole Bush thing, but just the pure material reality, to my mind at least, is quite different. And the real story is just the quote-unquote rise of China. I mean, China is just a mega power,
yes,
in a way that the United States hasn't faced, I mean, since the 1860s, when the Confederacy was trying to get the British to support it, right, during the Civil War. And I would just say that is the new reality. And it happened very, very quickly, within 20 years. That I think is going to underpin this geopolitical transition, a transition equivalent to when New York replaced London as a center of financial capital in the 20s. A giant epochal transition. I don't think the United States is not going to be powerful. I think it's going to be of equivalent power to China, but it is not going to be able to be, for example, regionally hegemonic in East Asia like it was for much of the 20th and part of the 21st century. Yeah, that is, I think, the difference. Not to deny the awesome power of the United States. It is still awesome. It is still mega powerful. Just the character of that power is going to be in relative decline. But guys, I got to go.
Okay. Thanks, Danny. It was great.
All right, yeah, bye, guys. Really talk soon. It.
Bye. Okay, well, I mean, I think we can still continue a little bit more after Danny's left.
We'll try to get through it somehow. Try to muddle through.
Exactly.
I wanted to switch gears, if you guys are okay with it, because there was something I wanted to talk to the two of you about, and it's the logic of the now, I guess, ubiquitous decapitation strike. And the
well,
fact
well
that
we wanted to talk about that, too. We were discussing it today. Yeah,
I'm curious, like, why this has become a thing again, or maybe the better question is, why did it disappear? Like, why did assassinating, you know, and I guess it's self-interest, right, for the leaders of, like, you don't want to be targeted, so why would you target somebody else? But I'm just sort of curious what the history of this is.
That's a great question.
This would be a good place to talk about it.
John, do you want, I have some thoughts on this, because I'm, but John, if you want to go first.
Well, I mean, the classic case is the cult of the assassins who were who started as a strange Shia splinter group in northern Iraq with a basically impregnable castle, or as it turned out, impregnable until they met the Mongols.
Until the Mongols showed up.
Yeah. A lot of people had that epiphany, if you could call it one. And usually with an arrow sticking out of their throat. Anyway, so the assassins had a lot of triumphs, and many of them against a world where feudal leaders, that is, you know, clans running countries or principalities with members of really one bloodline or two bloodlines. That is, they didn't have a lot of people to spare. But since 1945, a lot of big times for assassins. I mean, the Russian dissidents of the 19th century and so on. But most recently, Israel pushing the decapitation strategy. And I don't know, just squint from far back, take a few steps back, and that doesn't seem like it worked all that well. I mean, it worked all that well in the sense that Israel is still there, but not coincidentally, they had the world's strongest power backing them,
yeah,
and really backing them, like, you know, after the 73 war, all that time. What have they ever done with it? I mean, they're very good at it, but what does it accomplish?
Right. It doesn't seem to work, right?
I mean, think it's
to demoralize a society or bring a country down. Like, it's not working on Iran. Let's say that.
I think they do it because it's a way to dominate, but also a way, it is like a cult, especially in Israel, because they can, and it gives them the sense that they're dominating as well, whether they are or not. And in fact, John, I mean, I think you hit it on the head. The reason they are dominant is not entirely because of America, but hugely because they have, you know, the global hegemon backing them. They are also, as much as I loathe Israel, you know, they are good at that particular thing. They are good at the intelligence and assassinating, but it doesn't achieve anything strategically almost ever. In fact, usually when they assassinate over and over and over, and that was even kind of the point of Ronan Bergen's book, they wind up with worse and more dangerous people that they face. And I kind of think, you know, it reminds me a bit of this anecdote I heard when the first time I went to Israel in the early 90s, and talking to some of the more secular people about the Orthodox that they hate, that secular people hated then. I don't know, the country's different probably now. And the fact that the Orthodox, you know, then as now didn't serve in the military. And the Orthodox would argue that they shouldn't, for the safety of Israel and for the defense of Israel, they shouldn't serve, because it's obviously their praying during warfare that allowed Israel to win in 67 and 73 and 48. And how can you argue against it unless you say Judaism is all fake, you know? So, but like, they argue that, and I think they would also argue that the reason Israel is so powerful and dominant in the region is because of their prowess at assassinations. All of this is eliding the fact that, no, it's because you're backed by America in a way that America doesn't back any other country in the world. But I think, again, another thing I want to mention is that assassinating used to be a real taboo. And there were a lot of revelations in the Church and Pike Committee hearings in the mid-70s. But it was America's assassination program, which was illegal. And it's you know, it's a violation, of course, of international law, if anybody cares about that. But I think it was also illegal by American law. I can't remember if it was only made illegal by an EO after the revelations. But this was in terms of like what shocked conventional wisdom, even elites and, you know, educated people and so on, was the revelation that the U.S. had assassination programs. And I think they did a kind of controlled leak. I think they didn't quite, you know, what they released was already shocking enough all the times they tried to assassinate Lumumba, the assassination attempts on Castro, of course. With Lumumba, they tried, but the Belgians got him first. Castro, they tried over and over. I can't remember. There were, you know, maybe some other ones. I'm sure they actually did assassinate. And in response to that, because it was such a shock to polite society, to people in power, you know, Ford signed an executive order, it seemed like, banning assassinations. Carter then followed that up with an executive order that actually banned assassinations. Then Reagan came in with a new executive order that kind of fakely outlawed assassinations and fakely outlawed the CIA spying on Americans, but it kind of actually opened doors for it.
I mean, one of the ways, I forget how Mossadegh died. Was he assassinated?
No, he was just cooed.
He was in prison.
Okay, yeah, but like, you know, something like a soft assassination, in one sense, started the whole hatred of that still endures in some circles between Iran and the United States. I mean, I don't think there was any history of that. And even now, I've read that Iran is one of the few places that considers the U.S. just a kind of muscle-bound doofus, and actually it's the British who are running things who give him the orders.
Because we're too stupid, we're too meat-headed.
Yeah.
That's very funny. That reminds me of, like, you know, once Trump got elected, how all the Russian rhetoric about Ukraine turned to, like, oh, it's those damn Brits that are doing this to us. It's not the U.S. anymore.
Right.
It's the Brits. Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen Keir Starmer?
Like, I know.
Watch the way this man operates. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
He could do a wimp fight with anybody. I mean, he's...
Yeah,
only one would be left standing or even breathing at the end, but you know, it'd probably be him.
Yeah, what do you think, Derek, about this this decapitation policy? I mean, it is.
I think it's theater.
Yeah,
like, on some level, I think your point. You're right. It's a way for the Israelis to feel like they're achieving something, even if they're not, and nobody comes back and checks. You know, 5 years later, if the guy who replaced the guy you bumped off is actually worse and harder line, you just say, oh, well, here's a new guy we have to bump off, without connecting the dots and saying, like, we're the ones who put him in place in the first place. It really does feel like theater. And I guess this leads to a bigger question about Israel. And there's been in the last, even just the last couple of days, I've seen an increasing number of stories about, like, how long can Israel actually keep this up, even with the backing of the United States to the hilt. The United States is also seeming like it's overextended itself. Like, it's you know, running out of weapons. We're transferring things from East Asia to the Middle East because we're running out of systems. We're running out of munitions, air defenses. We're now telling all the people in the Ukrainian arms replenishment program that, hey, we're just going to take your money and replace or like replenish our own weapons. Yes. Like, fuck Ukraine. We're, you know, sorry. It really feels like the U.S. is pushing up against something. And here's Israel, you know, fighting a full scale air war against Iran, trying to occupy all of southern Lebanon up to the Litani River again. Still maintaining a blockade on, you know, anything coming in and out of Gaza, and, you know, killing people, you know, on a lower level, certainly, but still on an almost daily basis, maintaining enough of a presence in the West Bank to enable settler you know, violence against Palestinian communities. They're like, how, and maintaining a security presence in southern Syria, which they've now, you know, decided to occupy. Like, how long can you pull that off? They're calling up hundreds of thousands of reservists. You hear grumbling. I mean, you know, the support for all of this, of course, if you do polling among us, you know, Jewish Israelis is 90%, 95% for everything. But it feels like at some point something's got to break. Like, it's just too much for that country, even, again, with the backing of the United States, to maintain all of this stuff indefinitely.
Yeah, it does seem like that. I would just caution, those polls seem pretty real. I mean, Israeli society was already, you know, on a long trajectory of getting crazier and crazier. But October 7th just fully unlocked the most sort of genocidal, warlike, you know, instincts of the overwhelming majority of that country. And that, and the demographics are such that that trend is just going to keep continuing. So, you know, you might have less and less capacity to do all these things that you want to do. But just, again, watching so many wars over time, I mean, even if you have less and less capacity, if you have a state organized properly enough, and that state wants to keep on fighting, they're going to keep on fighting. Even if capacity is reduced, they'll just bomb and assassinate and occupy less, maybe, than they would have if they had full capabilities. That's my own sense. And I don't know, you know, I would have thought that we're now 2.5 years after October 7th. I kind of would have thought that outburst of genocidal rage and willingness to take, you know, to take a hit economically, to have actual, you know, to have casualties. I would have thought it would have kind of run its course by now, and it hasn't at all. It hasn't at all. It's almost more like it's become thoroughly and deeply embedded, or, as I said, like there was maybe just a thin veneer covering it and it just got unlocked. So it may take a while for that to exhaust itself. I mean, if the U.S. cut them off, you know, that would be a whole other story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm pessimistic about that. I don't know. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. When you're in a chain, a country that, as you said, starts to consider its tradition of victories divinely ordained, then that's kind of an intoxicating ideology, and one that would be very, very hard to cure yourself of.
I mean, I think that the question of the ultra-Orthodox military service is important here, because even with all the support, even if everybody's behind this, at some point you start to run, especially if the demographics are trending in the direction of, you know, Hasidic settler, you know, Orthodox families having more kids, higher birth rate, and like those guys not serving in the military. At some point, you're just going to run out of manpower, it seems like, unless you figure this out. And that's got to create resentments. I know there are resentments in that society
over this. Yeah.
And, you know, at some point, it's going to be, I think, very difficult. It's already, you know, straining, but very difficult to kind of pave those over as people look at this community and think, you know, why aren't you joining in the glorious wars to save?
But they
Israel,
are like, through prayer. Their prayers are the biggest bombs.
I'm not sure how that's going over with but yes.
But look at Yair Lapid and the things. So this is the alleged, you know, center left opposition.
Yeah.
And in some senses, he's kind of running to the right, to the kind of militaristic right of Netanyahu, really pushing for wiping out everybody. As I think he said, you know, south of the Litani, he's very open about it. Like, there's no space for anything but doing what they're doing. And I guess unless you like physically run out of gas, you don't have another ounce of gas, and you don't have horses you can use, you don't have bullets. Yeah, that's a real constraint. But I don't see them quite getting to that point yet. And you know, the American ruling classes are so deeply embedded with Zionism and Israel. And it's been a shock to a lot of people, certainly since October 7th, just how insane that embedment is, that Israel can count on it still for a while. I don't know how much longer, but it could be another 5 years, 10 years. Like, I don't think, even though Gavin Newsom said the word apartheid and then walked it back and apologized and cried, but like,
I think he should give a different answer on that question in every interview. Just like 180 at every time.
Yeah. He should actually just have cards and he just, that's number three. You're number three. Yeah. Here's number, I don't want to bother saying it, you know. But,
just read that.
Yeah. I just don't see them. I don't know what you think, but I think the bigger threat really comes to Israel, and the undying support for Israel really comes from the right, which you see it turning to, you know, something adjacent to anti-Semitism and stuff. Yeah. And I don't want to make this about anti-Semitism, because I'm sorry, but the Zionist crowd has done everything to bring on the worst paranoid conspiracy theories about, you know, Jews. Like, they're acting them out and bringing on this anti-Semitism and turning, they kind of bet everything on MAGA. Okay, you know, the damn liberals, they're going to get too woke and call us a settler colony, so we'll throw everything with MAGA, just and not taking seriously, like, just thinking the MAGA are a bunch of dupes. I mean, they kind of are, but
yeah,
they thought
a lot of them are Gila monsters. They won't have real venom in their dirty jaws.
So I don't know. I'm very pessimistic about where this war is going, because having, again, you know, watched how long other wars have gone on, and really, like, the Russia-Ukraine war, when Russia invaded in 2022, it was a real shock. It was a real shock, and there was a sense that, well, this has to be wrapped up soon. And I think that was Putin's plan, was to try to, you know, flip the table and try to turn things back towards a more favorable, you know, deal from their point of view, vis-a-vis NATO and all that stuff. And instead, here we are, you know, more than 4 years in, and Ukraine is like literally running out of people. You know, they're running out of people, but they're still in the fight. And, you know, Russia is slowly attriting them, but if the Europeans keep funding Ukraine and they think it's in their interest to, I don't know how many more years that could go on. So I feel like these wars could go on potentially for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sectarian, multi-generational problem, and those are very, very slow to get resolved unless there's overwhelming support, as there was in dissolving the so-called white colonies of Southern Africa. I mean, you take another example like Northern Ireland. I think it was in like 1921 that Rudyard Kipling, God bless him, wrote, Ulster will fight and Ulster will be right. And I visited there maybe 2 years ago, and I don't know, the cars are updated, but not much else has changed there.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, like, when you, again, look at what the options are for, let's say, for Trump or where this war is going, I mean, there kind of are only two options at this point. Either Trump and Israel, I mean, Israel, even if there's a, Netanyahu is in less danger, I think, no matter what happens. Probably, I don't know. But Trump and the Gulf states either agree to a really humiliating, ceasefire deal in which Iran will have real security guarantees, will have its ballistic missile program, will have a lot more power overtly than it did before, and that's part of the security agreement, and I can't see them agreeing to that. Or Iran is, like, destroyed. And I don't think Iran's going to be destroyed, but I think there's going to be a long, hard attempt by the rich powers, which is the Gulf states and the U.S. and ultimately probably all the vassals in, you know, Canada and Europe, that they're gonna work on trying to destroy Iran and trying to break it so that it gives in. And that's why I think this is going to go on a long time.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, the Gulf states just make me laugh because they're doing the, like, hold me back, bro thing. which is like, yes. what are you, who are you trying to
yeah, that is good.
Isn't the UAE, the UAE may be as annoying as Israelis. Like, UAE stands, yes. they're the most
like their new thing is like, we will definitely participate in an international military effort to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Oh, okay, yeah, why don't you just get started? And, like, we'll come in and catch up.
Even like Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis get annoyed with them.
Yes.
Like, Bahrain said they were going to go to the Security Council. They've got a draft, I guess, at the Security Council for, like, authorizing military force to reopen the strait. And it's like, well, you guys have two frigates. Get cracking. Like, you know, you got a navy. Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah.
They're in a position now where they're desperate to get back to or convince everybody that, you know, it's still safe to do business here. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to try and get something out of this that restores that sense of just basic safety. Short of decimating Iran, like, what are you gonna do?
British tabloid celebrities back. I don't know why, but somehow they do. I mean, you read the Daily Mail and it's like, everybody is leaving Kuwait.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't see how... Among other things, I don't see really how the UAE comes back from this, because the UAE is much more than just a petro state. The UAE is like a financial and logistics. It made itself that.
The Dubai model. I don't know how that comes back. I don't know how much longer they had with that anyway, because, you know, I mean, when you get to the point where it's 180 degrees during the day in August, like, like, nobody's going to be able to live there anyway or choose to live there. Like, it feels very ephemeral, even without this conflict kind of shaking things up, how much longer you're going to be able to sustain that system, which is one that the other Gulf states, the rich ones at least, the Saudis and the Qataris, are trying to copy. I mean, they're trying to go after this same demographic of, like, being a travel hub for business people, being a corporate hub. The Saudis have been trying to strong arm. That's why they've been not getting along with the UAE for a while now.
Yeah, I think the Saudi elite is just plain bored. I mean, decadent and bored.
Yeah.
And all the things they want to do are done by those people. But officially, the Saudi elite has all this money and all this time, God knows. And they're not quite allowed to do them, and it rankles. And that's about it. They want to do those things.
Yeah, no, they want to be. I think they had a they basically imposed a new kind of rule that if you want to do business in Saudi Arabia, you have to move your headquarters of your regional business from Dubai to Riyadh.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was after the UAE pulled out of Yemen on them, which was the start of, I think, the.
Yeah.
I mean, first passed, I thought, so if somebody has a female executive on their board, are they going to have a driver with them?
Yeah. Seriously.
Hard to believe.
A guardian at all times. Yeah. Right. So, I don't know how we can wrap this up. Derek, I mean, it's been great talking to both you guys, actually.
Yeah, this has been great.
To have, like, all of us together. Really. Yeah. And we should definitely do more of these down the line. And I'm looking forward to, Danny's book as well. And, but I really appreciate you guys talking to us. And
we appreciate you guys talking to us. It's been this has been really fun. Maybe there won't be a war going on next time.
Something more. Then we're all out of business, aren't we? Yeah.
Well, that's true.
I don't think there's going to be any let up in the rush of business. You know, we're going to have to keep handing out wars like pizza slices and kips.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. Well, on that happy note, I think we can end the episode. Thank you again, guys. American Prestige. And everyone, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.